TNT Radio wants to know what you really think. From COVID-19, the Ukraine conflict, the persecution of Julian Assange, corrupt government, the WEF, digital IDs and digital currency, the Great Reset, the disassembling of the West, and the destruction of the world as we once knew it. Your opinion matters. It's time to get on our soapbox and tell us what you really think at TNTRadio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. This is the Freeman Report with your host, James Freeman, on today's news talk radio, TNT.
Hello, welcome back. It's Thursday, the 19th of January. We've just had a great first hour of the show with James Bembridge talking about everything from Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, to the Twitter files, censorship and lockdowns and much more. If you missed the show, you can catch up tomorrow via the TNT Radio website. So that's tntradio.live or via your favorite podcast streaming sites. Right. Okay. Next up, we have a very, very special doctor who has dedicated her career to women's health. Tina Pears is a consultant doctor in contraception and reproductive health. But as she's been very, very outspoken recently, she was on with Nigel Farage a couple of weeks ago, talking about the impact that the lockdowns have had on people's well-being and health, but also early treatment of COVID, or the lack of it, I should say. And also, Tina is a bit of an expert on long COVID, so we'll be talking about all of those topics. In a moment, I'll be joined by Dee Dee Denslow to talk about one of the big stories of the day. But firstly, I want to talk a little bit about long COVID. Now, the UK House of Lords Library published a report on the short and long-term challenges of long COVID in November 2022. It says that COVID is commonly used to describe the symptoms. Sorry, it says long COVID is commonly described, used to describe the symptoms that persist and develop 4 weeks after contracting COVID-19. It goes on to say that with no evidence-based treatment available for long COVID, the condition has impacted the health and employment of people suffering from it. In terms of tackling the challenges presented by the condition, the government announced funding to NHS England to support those with long COVID. And the government has also funded research into studies to better understand the condition. Now, I have some questions on this and some thoughts. When the idea of long COVID first started getting pushed in the media, I did wonder if it was a cover for people who'd been vaccine injured, because there is an overlap in some of the symptoms. But it seems that long COVID is a real thing. We can argue about how many people are suffering from it, but I think I've been convinced that it is a real thing. You know, there are post-viral illnesses that you can get from flu and other viruses as well. Now, the other thoughts I have is that the Office for National Statistics runs a COVID tracking survey. It's a self-reporting survey. It's all done to statistical standards. And the government, the UK government, allocates money for treatment of long COVID based upon the results of that survey. Now, I have a problem with this because, you know, first of all, I suspect that at least some of those diagnosed with long COVID, let's just back up there a second. They haven't been diagnosed. They're reporting, self-reporting the fact that they've got long COVID after having COVID. So first of all, I would question how many of them actually have been injured by the vaccines. But more importantly, why is self-reported data valid for long COVID but not valid for vaccine injuries? In the UK here, we have the yellow card reporting system, which has reports of vaccine injuries from around, I think it's over now, 500,000 people just in the UK. And there are thousands of reports with people with serious conditions being attributed to the vaccine. It's self-reported data, just like the ONS survey. So why doesn't the UK government use this data to allocate money to treat the vaccine injured? You know, I talk regularly with the support groups such as UKCV Family. That's the largest vaccine injured support group in the UK. They have nearly 1,000 members now. So why is the UK government using self-reported data from ONS surveys but ignoring its own system, the yellow card reporting system, and it's not giving money to help support and treat people that have been injured by the vaccines? I'll be talking about this in a minute with Dr. Tina Pears. But first, if you miss any of our shows, like my interview with Dr. Aseem Malhotra or Dr. Tess Laurie this week, then don't panic, because you can watch, you can listen to them the following day after broadcast via the TNT website, or like I said earlier, via all of the leading podcast streaming platforms. Right, after this quick jingle, we'll be back with Dee Dee Denslow to talk about one of the biggest stories of the day. My name's James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.
Talking the talk.
I like the conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, so union workers threaten to leave MPs without power. What's this story all about, Darren?
Yeah, if only if British workers and British unions operated in a, maybe took a similar approach to the problems we face like the French do. You know, they do love a strike. They do love a protest over there. The Yellow Vests and the Gilets Jaunes have also been on the move in recent weeks. France's second largest trade union suggests cutting lawmakers and billionaires' electricity off ahead of a nationwide strike. French authorities say they will deploy thousands of police officers and their batons on Thursday in response to major nationwide protests being organised by the General Confederation of Labour, the CGT, the country's second largest trade union, which has also threatened to cut off electricity supply to MPs and billionaires. Union workers in sectors such as transportation, education, and energy announced they would be going on strike and holding rallies after the government proposed a bill last week that would see the retirement age raised from 62 to 64. A rising of retirement ages that we see across the world. Polls have shown that the move is opposed by the vast majority of French citizens, many of whom are currently facing a cost of lockdown crisis. According to union and transport operators cited by Reuters, it's expected that public transport will be the most effective on Thursday as a result of the strike, with many trains and flights being cancelled and Paris's subway experiencing significant disruptions. Additionally, 7 out of 10 primary school teachers are expected to walk off the job, as are many refinery workers. I suggest they also go see the nice properties, the nice castles of billionaires, CGT leader Philippe Martinez told France 2 on Wednesday, adding that it would be good if we cut off their electricity so they can put themselves for a few days in the shoes of French people who can't afford to pay the bill. So France is experiencing strikes. Not really. Normally we'd say, well, that isn't unusual, strikes and protests in France.
Yes.
But actually, they are the same sort of industries and sectors, public sector employees who are striking in France, just as they are in the UK. We are seeing other types of industrial action across the EU, in the US, in Australia. I'm not saying it's all coordinated, but at least in France, when they protest and they strike, they actually do threaten at least meaningful action, and they tend to be very productive in achieving their outcomes, James. The outcomes they desire, James.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to talk more generally about the strikes, actually, because and I think we can differentiate between the different strikers. So, you know, in the UK here, we've got obviously the rail unions are striking, but we've also got our healthcare workers that are striking as well. Before I give my opinion, I'm gonna ask for yours, Darren, and then I'll see if we agree. What's your on the nurses in particular? Can you just what do you think of their strikes?
I believe that everybody has the right to protest their employment conditions if they are not happy with them. I know I taught nurses. I taught nurses or potential nurses that used to go on to university. I taught on access courses. I know all about their pay structure and what their pay is like. For nurses to come out and say they're not being paid enough, maybe when you say, you know, when you look at what they do, nurses, doctors, teachers, those type of employees or workers should be some of the highest paid people in our society, and they are not. Nevertheless, nurses' pay is actually quite good. I lived with a nurse. She was clearing thousands and thousands every month and complained about her pay. And they've had it fairly easy through the pandemic. That's my opinion on the information and data that I have seen. They spent a year TikTok dancing. But in the same breath, the implications of nurses and doctors going on strike for a pay rise, which it would be seen as excessive by anyone's own estimation. You know, they want an above of inflation pay rise. The impact on our health service is obviously going to be quite catastrophic. And we may be seeing that in the excess deaths and the problems with getting people into the hospital because the ambulance service is on strike. So it's a really, really tough one. No, I'm not sat on the fence. I believe that the nurses should continue to work.
Like you're getting splinters there on your bum, Dan.
I believe that the nurses should continue to work. They shouldn't be striking, and they should accept the pay offer that they've been given by the government. That's my opinion. Teachers shouldn't be striking. Their pay, not great, brutal job teaching, but shouldn't be striking. The transport network, yeah, they shouldn't be striking. And I believe all these actions which are being coordinated by the unions are just an attack on the government, and actually, really, all it is an attack on a beleaguered public who are relying on these services. So that's my opinion.
I've got a few things. Thank you, Darren. I really appreciate you giving your opinion. I've got a few opinions of myself on this. One of the things that we've seen over the span of the pandemic is we've seen a huge transfer of wealth happen. We've got more billionaires being created. And at the same time now, we've got hyperinflation because the government printed loads of money to get people to stay at home. It was all based upon government policy. Now, I'll talk about the nurses specifically. And I think we should be careful, a little bit careful about, you know, obviously there were lots of videos and TikToks about nurses and doctors dancing and everything. But, you know, I don't blame what's happened over the last couple of years on the healthcare professionals. Hospitals are run like a military operation. They have to be because of the nature of the job, and they do what they're told. So, you know, I don't think they can be blamed for some of the failings. And they have been asked to do some pretty ridiculous things over the last years with quarantine and other measures. And of course, they were on the front line. And, you know, I think a lot of us during the first wave, when we were still a little bit unsure, it was pretty scary, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And yet these brave people went on the front line, quite often without PPE, and they carried on with their job regardless. Now, if we look at, like I said, I'm going to talk about nurses specifically. If we look at nurses' pay, well, they, since 2010, it might be earlier than that, they've had below inflation pay rises. They've also had below average wage pay rises when you compare against all of the other jobs in the economy. They do shift work, including night shifts and day shifts. And over recent years, over the same period that their wage has been dropping, they're being asked to do more and more. So a lot of the responsibilities that doctors have had in the past have now landed on nurses. And, you know, I was listening to the news yesterday and I was hearing about the fact that nurses are on an average pay of around 35,000. You know, I'm a statistician. You need to be very, very careful with averages because, you know, most nurses will not be being paid that much, or there's certainly a lot of nurses will not being paid that much. And when you live in London or one of the big cities these days in particular, £35,000 is not enough to live on. So, you know, I've got a lot of sympathy. Like I said, we've got, at the same time as the government saying, no, you can't have an inflation-based wage rise, on the same time as that happening, we've got new billionaires being created all of the time, and a lot of the big bosses as well at all these big corporations. And certainly, you know, the head of the NHS managers, we've got far too many of them as well. They're all getting pay rises. So I've got a lot of sympathy, actually. I do understand about the problems. Have such a critical care sector when people go on strike. But I think the government has a lot to answer for here. They've created all of these economic problems, them and their friends in the WEF. So I've got a lot of sympathy, actually, Darren. And I, like I said, it's more complicated than that because we've got rail union strikers as well and other sectors as well. But certainly for, I think, nurses and people in the healthcare system, I've got a lot of sympathy. Okay, Darren, well, thank you for joining me. We'll be back on again together tomorrow. Have a lovely day. And if you're listening, please tune in to DD Denslow later. I think you're on at 2 o'clock, Darren.
I'm on at 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. And I've got some real good guests lined up. I've got Mark Steele and I've got Brad from Five Times August coming on. So please tune in at 1 p.m.
Fantastic. Definitely recommend you do that. Okay, we're going to take a quick short break now. My name's James Freeman. This is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.
Brian McLean on TNT Radio.
We got a 2A win right here going on. The U.S. government bump stock ban has been struck down by the court. The U.S. government was wrong when it said a ban on machine guns applied to bump stocks. A federal court ruled on January 6th. See, good things happen on January 6th, too. The move backed by then-President Donald Trump came after a man carried out a mass shooting in Las Vegas. Allegedly, I'm going to throw in allegedly here, using bump stocks to fire more rapidly. But what I want to point out here is that these highly politicized events that get basically sealed, where we don't have access to, you know, the forensic evidence and all of the court evidence and proper discovery is not done. These things like the Stephen Paddock incident in Las Vegas 2018, almost all of these things lead to inevitable legislation. And that is not good. That's not good when you've got a government that is writing legislation based on a media narrative when the public has no access to facts.
Hesher on TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
What the fourth industrial revolution will lead to is a fusion of our physical, our digital, and our biological identities. The WEF promotes transhumanism. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back with me, James Freeman, on the Freeman Report. It's Thursday, the 19th of January, and I have a very, very special guest on the line with me, Dr. Tina Pierce. Hello, Tina.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm fantastic today, actually. Thank you so much for joining me. I wonder if you'd first give a quick introduction to yourself and say kind of, you know, what you do as a doctor and a little bit about your background.
Okay. Well, it's a great pleasure to be speaking to you and thank you very much for inviting me to come on the show. I trained as a GP originally many years ago. I qualified in 1983 and trained as a GP. Worked as a GP part-time for 7 years whilst I had my three children. And then I moved out of general practice and became a consultant in contraception and reproductive healthcare. And for 24 years, I ran the reproductive contraceptive services for Surrey, really. And then I also became a menopause specialist. But I developed an extra interest alongside all of that. In 2016, I started learning about mast cell activation syndrome, or MCAS, because my youngest daughter had it and was very, very ill with it. And we couldn't find anybody really who knew anything about it in the UK at that time. And it was really difficult. But anyway, I became a bit of a sort of, it became an interest of mine. And I started treating people, diagnosing them and treating them really from 2016, almost by accident, because once you know something, you can't help but see it. After giving up the NHS in my contraceptive services, I concentrated on women's health more and treating patients with MCAS. And then when COVID came along, it seemed to me that what I was hearing fitted with a very much an MCAS type picture, both for acute COVID and long COVID. So I started treating acute COVID very successfully and opened a long COVID clinic in the 1st of November 2021, and have been treating long COVID. And I also see some patients with vaccine injuries. So that's me in a nutshell, really.
Fantastic. And I've got some really, really, really interesting questions for you. You probably weren't listening before the break, but I've got a lot of questions on long COVID. I think initially when I heard about long COVID, I was quite skeptical. I thought, is this a cover for people being injured with the vaccines? I think I've been persuaded now. I believe there is such a thing as long COVID, and I think it's very similar to other post-viral infections that you can get from flu and other things. I think where I have a problem still is the Office for National Statistics actually collects a lot of data on long COVID via its COVID tracker, and it's all self-reported data. And based upon that data, the UK government has allocated a lot of money to treat long COVID. Now, I'd love to hear your opinion on this, because the yellow card system is also a self-reported system. It's actually run by the government itself, and there's actually, you know, nearly, I think, 500,000 reports of vaccine injuries on there. A lot of them will be fairly minor, but there are thousands of quite serious vaccine injury reports on there. And the government is just ignoring that. And it's saying that it's self-reported data. So it's just ignoring it. Whereas on long COVID, it's allocating money to treat people. What are your thoughts on that?
There's so many discrepancies in what they say and do, aren't there? I mean, it's quite unbelievable, really. The my feeling is this, that about 17% of the population, we believe, have got an inherited condition or a propensity to get mast cell activation syndrome. So they have abnormal mast cells that have they've either been born with or have become abnormal because of various traumas that they've had in their life, from infections, from emotional trauma, and so on. And these patients are the ones who I believe will get ME, post-viral fatigue syndrome, and so on. And COVID is no dissimilar to any other virus. So if you've got this tendency to for your immune system not to switch off after you've had an infection and to keep going and then to cause inflammation in your body and lots of symptoms and to make you feel ill and tired and have brain fog and so on, then COVID will do that to you as well. And that's what I believe is long COVID, as you quite rightly say, sort of post-viral fatigue, post-viral syndrome. And they do respond very well to the treatment for mast cell activation syndrome. So that's sort of, you know, the proof clinically is that they respond well, and therefore we're going up the right street, really. We're, you know, onto something. When it comes to the vaccine, my patients who've got mast cell activation syndrome and have had the vaccine, the vaccine always makes them worse, except for one lady. One lady she felt better after the vaccine. But everyone else, it turns their mast cell activation syndrome on again, and it makes them worse. So it sets them back. We may have improved their mast cell activation, we may have improved their symptoms of long COVID. And then whenever they've had a vaccine, they've actually gone backwards. And so I think something similar is at play there. And we need to look into it more. We need to do some more research and to understand this properly. And I think that, you know, when it comes to adverse events being reported on the MHRA, I think it's grossly underreported. I think there's so many patients I speak to who have had some very nasty reactions to the vaccine, and they haven't recorded them on the MHRA website. They haven't even known about it. So it's way underreported. Even the MHRA did some studies a few years ago and said that they thought only 10% was ever reported to them of any adverse reactions. And in America, the VAERS system, some estimates are that it's actually only 1 in 30 cases are reported. And that could be for various reasons. You know, people don't make the connection, or they don't know about the system. They don't know that anyone can report it. They think a doctor has to report it, and so on. So it's not a foolproof system at all. But we do need to be looking at the numbers, and we need to be investigating it. It's not an easy form to fill out. It's not something you're going to do willy-nilly just for fun. It's only going to be something that you do if you felt, you know, you did have a reaction, and it needs investigating. And unless we gather this information and look further into it, we're not going to know, are we?
Well, certainly not. And I've got loads of questions from that, Tina. But we're just going to go to a very, very quick break. So stay with me and we'll carry on this conversation after the break.
What station is this?
Station. Ladies and gentlemen.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. The United States has been accused of stealing oil from Syria, draining the country of the crucial commodity. Russia's announced plans to boost its standing army to 1.5 million troops over the next 3 years. And in a shock announcement, New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has announced she's quitting, standing down as the nation's leader 9 months before the general election.
Do you have a suggestion for a possible guest you'd like to hear on TNT Radio?
Or perhaps you have a topic you feel we should discuss?
Then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio.
Welcome back with me, James Freeman, on the Freeman Report. Right, I'm eager to get stuck back in. I've got Dr. Tina Pierce on the line with me because I've got loads of questions from what she's just said before the break. So this is the reason I love talking to the experts, because, you know, things that I'd assumed and things that I think, and, you know, quite often get proved wrong, and I understand things in much more detail. And Tina's just said something really important, because I was thinking that, you know, that long COVID was getting conflated with vaccine damage, and actually it was almost a cover for that. But what actually Tina's just said is that long COVID can be caused by the vaccines and made worse by the vaccines. And that is a revelation to me. I think it's very, very interesting. Do you think, is the government aware of this? Is there any research pointing to this that the government's aware of, Tina?
I don't know that they're aware of it, but I did see something rather alarming, and that was that they were going to close the long COVID clinics. Now, I don't know how accurate that report was, but that they were actually going to pull the funding from the long COVID clinics. And that's something that we need to find out about, because there's an awful lot of people who would be affected by that. Not that some of the long COVID clinics were very good. What they were good at, the NHS long COVID clinics, was fully investigating people. So if they had POTS type symptoms, they would send them for ECGs, do tilt tests on them, send them to a cardiologist. If they had gut issues, they would send them to a gastroenterologist. They'd be fully investigated. So the clinics were very good from that point of view, and checking out everything and all the symptoms. But they didn't seem to be very good at treating people, from what the patients were telling me. And they were telling people to rest, which, yes, you know, but that's not going to make them better. And there is medication that can help them, and lifestyle changes that can help them. And quite funnily, quite a few of my patients who came to the long COVID clinic said they'd waited maybe 6-9 months to be seen in the NHS clinic. And when they got there and they'd had all their tests, and all the tests are usually normal, they were told by the staff at the clinic, well, go and see Dr. Tina Pierce because she's treating long COVID, which I thought was quite hilarious, really, because if I was treating it, why couldn't they treat it? And or why didn't they contact me and say, what are you doing? I didn't make it a secret. I've never made it a secret what I'm doing, because I want everyone to be able to know about this and to help themselves and to get treatment, appropriate treatment. And so there's a lot of information on my website about it. But there's also, I put together a long COVID international conference in June of 2021. And it was a 2-day conference. 2,200 people attended. I was hoping it'd be lots of doctors and healthcare professionals who would want to learn about the treatment of long COVID. It was mostly patients. I think we had 100 healthcare professionals and the rest were all patients. I suppose at least it empowers patients to know what to do and how to do it. And to start these conversations with their doctors. But, you know, I was hoping that we'd have tens of thousands of people interested and eager to learn how to help their patients and to treat the long COVID. But anyway, I think it's put mast cell activation syndrome on the map. I hear much more talk about it now from colleagues, whereas before they hadn't even heard of it. So that's a very big positive thing that's happened and come out of this, isn't it?
Yeah, well done you. I'm really chuffed that you're doing that, and you seem to be, ahead of the curve. I think on long COVID. I guess the only thing I would say to the government though is, you know, I think, and Sir Christopher Chope has called for this as well, is that similar money needs to be put into setting up clinics to help the vaccine injured, because I know people that have been injured by the vaccines that have been turned away from long COVID clinics, despite the fact that actually some of the symptoms, there is quite a big overlap, I think, on some of the symptoms. Am I right in saying that?
You are, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. I've got patients who have had vaccine injuries who have been turned away from long COVID clinics, and there is literally nowhere for them to go. And it's absolutely tragic. And actually, I know a doctor who works in a long COVID clinic, and she confided in me that actually, they were told to reject people who had any vaccine injuries, and that they were definitely not to see them or talk to them or help them. And this is heartbreaking. I mean, the people who have been injured by the vaccine, and they're not to be helped and listened to, is absolutely despicable. It is shameful of the medical profession, I think. It is appalling that these poor people are being gaslighted, ignored, and not getting the help that they need. I mean, you and I both know UK CV Family, an amazing organisation trying to help people who have suffered a vaccine injury. And they support each other, and they educate each other, and they try and find help. And they're trying to work with, you know, to raise awareness in the public and the government. I think incredible people behind that. And they need all our support. They really do. I think we should be opening. I think the long COVID clinics should be ME clinics, actually. They should be encompassing anyone who has any post-viral problems, so that we don't leave out the poor ME patients too, because they've been very neglected over the years often. And I think there should be clinics for the vaccine injured. And I think there should be cardiology clinics being opened up everywhere to check everybody's heart who's had the vaccine. Because we're seeing all these sudden deaths, which are unexplained. The first week of January, it was 2,808. Appalling, of sudden unexplained deaths, which are just seem to be ignored by the government, which is bizarre, and the MHRA. And we really need to start holding these people to account. These deaths need to be investigated. We need to stop the vaccine program immediately whilst we investigate and look at all of this properly before more harm is done. It's not normal to have 2,808 excess deaths in a week. It's unbelievable. And we know a lot of those are cardiac deaths. And so we should be you know, we need to be checking everyone's hearts before they go running or go on the football pitch or, you know, go to the gym or whatever. We should be checking everybody.
Exactly. And if Rishi Sunak is listening in or Steve Barclay, I doubt very much they are, but if they're listening in, I recommend that they put Dr. Tina Pears in charge of this policy, because these sound like extremely rational and intelligent suggestions. Thank you, Tina. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about early treatment of COVID, because I know this is something else that you've been doing. I think there's far few doctors have actually been treating COVID. Certainly during the peak of the pandemic, people were just told if they had COVID just to go home, and if it got really, really bad, to call an ambulance, which does seem a bit ridiculous, because there are, you know, obviously we've all heard of ivermectin, but there are other remedies as well, very simple, cheap remedies that you can take, which will help fight off the disease, such as vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin E, and zinc, and other things. What's your experience and view on this, Tina?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are so many things that people can buy over the counter that can really, really help to treat this virus. So quite early on in the spring of 2020, when the reports were coming out of Italy of various postmortems that were being conducted, and the results of those postmortems showed that in the lungs, they had hyperinflammation, they had a breakdown of membranes, they had some clotting, and they had some bleeding. And to me, that just reminded me, and we were talking, do you remember, we were all talking about this cytokine storm and the reaction, yeah, the hyperinflammation that people were suffering from and dying from. And to me, that just really shouted out mast cell activation syndrome, is the mast cells are being too overactive in some patients causing this, because the cytokines are, you know, histamine, which causes inflammation, elastase 2, which causes membranes to break down, heparin, which causes blood to bleeding, and some clotting factors are also released, which can cause clotting. So that meant to me, it's that I thought, well, okay, so now if we treat acute COVID as if we're treating mast cell activation syndrome, then that should work. And lo and behold, it did. And so when patients came to me who had were quite severely ill with the, you know, remember Alpha and Delta variants were really quite nasty, yeah, much nastier than Omicron. And, you know, and they when we were on a Zoom together, they were coughing so much, they couldn't even talk. You know, they were just, they looked awful, they felt awful. And so I told them, right, vitamin D high doses, 10,000 units a day, vitamin C, you know, 4 to 5 grams a day, zinc, selenium, magnesium, quercetin, which you can buy over the counter, that's a mast cell stabilizer. Hey ho, it works, you know. And then antihistamines that you can buy over the counter. So loratadine or cetirizine, 10 milligrams, but you don't, on the box, it'll say once a day. Don't take it once a day. Take it 1, 3 times, 4 times a day. And also go on a low histamine diet, stop the tea, the coffee, the alcohol, obviously probably too ill to drink that anyway, but tea, coffee, green tea, tomatoes, avocados, spinach, things that are, and gluten, which are really high in histamine, because you don't want to add more histamine to your system when you've already got this massive histamine release from your mast cells because of the virus. That causes the inflammation and many of the symptoms. Well, when I started recommending this to patients, so they didn't even need a prescription. Okay. And also take some aspirin, because we know that it was causing clotting. So they take this, they can buy it over the counter, and lo and behold, within 24 to 48 hours, they were all very much better. So even people who were in bed coughing, the next day they would find the coughing had stopped. They were able to get up, get dressed, have a shower, you know. And we're like, it's amazing, amazing transformation. And I've treated only 50 people maybe with acute COVID, but every single one of them has responded in that way. Now, some of them on paper should have been, especially in the initial phases of the Alpha and Delta, should have probably gone to hospital at some point if I hadn't intervened. So I had one chap, he was an alcoholic, smoker, chain smoker, alcoholic, who'd already had two heart attacks. Now, you know, on paper, you think, wow, he's got all these comorbidities. He's in his 60s. He's not a well, healthy man. And he was absolutely overcome with the virus. He would probably have ended up going to hospital, where within 24 hours, he stopped coughing. And he was better within 3 days. So simple remedies, things that you can buy over the counter. Everyone should have them in their cupboards ready to go. And everyone should be taking vitamin D anyway, because we don't get enough in this country, and vitamin C to boost their immune systems. So there's so much we can do. And there's so much the government could have done, telling people to get fit, lose weight, take vitamin D, etc., which would have just made them, you know, if they had caught the virus, much more robust. But we must remember also that the actual number of people who died purely from the virus was incredibly low, not as we were led to believe. Now, somebody did a Freedom of Information request to the Office of National Statistics, and this will shock a lot of people. They asked how many people just had COVID on their death certificate and nothing else on their death certificate. So purely died from COVID, and from the 1st of February until the from February 2020 to December 2021, and it was 6,214 people.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
Now, some people will have died with comorbidities and COVID, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the COVID killed them. And they're not included in that, but purely COVID. But we were being led to believe that there were literally over 100,000 deaths from COVID. And that's not the case. Also, the average age of death in this country was 83 for women and 81 for men. And now with Omicron, it's even higher. I think it's 85 or 86. And those people had comorbidities. They were not fit, healthy generally. My father's 90. He had COVID in October and he was absolutely fine.
You've just blown my mind there, Tina. That is amazing what you've just said there. I mean, I was aware that there were some simple remedies to help combat COVID, but my big question there is, why the hell was the government, and why is the government now not even recommending these remedies? Right, we're just going to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere, Tina. We'll be back in a second. My name's James Freeman. This is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
What if I told you that we're overcounting the number of COVID deaths in the United States? You may say, of course we are. Or you may ask, how the heck would you know? Well, the claim isn't coming from me, but rather from a very familiar face and voice, CNN medical contributor Dr. Leanne Wen. She's penned a piece in the Washington Post, and she asks if Americans are dying from COVID or with COVID. Wen spoke with an infectious disease expert who points out every hospitalized patient gets tested for COVID. Many are incidentally positive. A gunshot victim or someone who had a heart attack could test positive, but the infection has no bearing on why they sought medical care. And if these patients die, COVID might get added to their death certificate along with other diagnoses. But the coronavirus was not the primary reason for their death, or often played no role at all. Wen notes a Massachusetts study showing only about 30% of total hospitalizations with COVID were primarily attributed to the virus. Would anyone be surprised if that number is accurate? Not me. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
In regional and rural areas of our great country, the sun brings a heavy toll. Skin cancer hits us hard. And if you've spent a lot of time out under the sun, your risk is high. Melanoma is the deadliest skin cancer, but it's curable if you get it early. Monthly skin checks are a must. If a spot, mole, or freckle doesn't look or feel right, don't wait. To find out more, visit melanomapatients.org.au.
My neighbor is so excited. He just filled up his gas tank for $28. The bad news is it was his lawnmower.
I got the high.
This sucks.
High gas prices blues.
Come on, man.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. My name's James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report. And on the line, I've got a very, very special doctor, Dr. Tina Pears. And what I'd like to speak with her about next is about excess deaths. Now, in the UK, excess deaths have been running since around May of 2022, so quite a long time now, and they're averaging around 1,000 a week since that time, give or take. It's around 10%, give or take a few percentages each week, but it's pretty consistent. Now, some of those deaths are due to COVID. I think it's in the region of a couple of hundred, give or take. But of course, we all know the problems of dying with or dying of COVID. But when you actually dig down into the data, there are a few stark things that come out. Firstly, that the excess deaths are across all age groups. People in their 20s, people in their 30s, 40s, and so on. But also, once you start looking at the causes, one of the leading causes, including in young people, is heart problems. People, young people are in the UK, are dying unexpectedly of heart problems. Now, before Christmas, we had the British Heart Foundation saying that it was down to delays in ambulance times, response times. I think we can discount that for young people, because whilst that may be causing a few extra deaths, it doesn't explain why people are having heart attacks in the first place. And then a couple of weeks ago, we had Sir Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer in the UK, saying that it was down to people missing regular health checkups with their GP, and it was a drop in statins. Now, Carl Hennigan has come out since then. He's the director of evidence-based medicine at Oxford University, and he's dug into the data on statins, and he's proved that it's nothing to do with statins. Tina, what are your thoughts on all of these excess deaths?
I think it's absolutely tragic. In all my years as a qualified doctor, I've never known anything like it. And these aren't young people who have cardiac problems, like, you know, congenital cardiac issues and so on. They are previously fit, healthy young people who are suddenly dropping down dead. And it needs to be investigated immediately. And we need to stop doing what we all think and is causing it straight away. Even if that's wrong, there's no danger from Omicron now. There is absolutely no danger from Omicron. We know that the vaccine, so-called vaccine, doesn't stop people catching it. It doesn't stop people spreading it, which is bizarre because all other vaccines do. So that's very odd. You know, there isn't a single vaccine that you're only protected if somebody else is protected next to you. That's ridiculous. If you've had it, you shouldn't care whether anyone else has had it or not, because you're protected. So you know, this isn't a proper vaccine. There are people now calling out, more and more people, medical people, calling out for the vaccine rollout to stop whilst we investigate and help all these people who may have been affected. So Dr. Paul Offit, who is an FDA chief, he was in the vaccine advisory group of the FDA. He has called for it to stop in the New England Journal of Medicine. And he's a professor of vaccinology and pediatrics. And he's saying that there is too many people dropping down dead, and we have to stop the vaccines. You know Asim Malhotra, Dr. Asim Malhotra, who's a cardiologist, he's calling for it. Loads of people, the World Council for Health, are calling for it. In Japan, they are investigating all these sudden deaths and causes that it could be all for the vaccine. So there are more and more countries around the world looking and saying, hang on, this isn't right. We must look at it. But it's so bizarre, isn't it? It's so bizarre why it's taken so long. You know, most vaccines, if there is one death in 100,000 people, it's pulled immediately. And this one, within 2 months of the release of the vaccine, Pfizer knew that there had been 1,200 deaths from the vaccine itself, specifically in their post-launch sort of vigilance, and they'd said nothing. It's just, it beggars
belief. Another bit of evidence which suggests that our regulator isn't doing its job properly, the MHRA, which regulates medical products, is the AstraZeneca story. So I'll summarize it very quickly. So March 2021, Several regulators across the world, European regulators, started finding a safety signal with the AstraZeneca vaccine. And at the end of March, I think about five or six different countries pulled the vaccine. Now, Denmark at the time had vaccinated, I think, around about 700, nearly 800,000 people, and they had found a clear safety signal. The MHRA at the time, even though we'd vaccinated, I think it was in the region of about 20 million by that point in the UK, they hadn't found a signal, and they put a public statement out saying so. So they carried on the rollout in the UK. And we now know from yellow card reports, but not only that, but actually from coroner's reports. So coroners sometimes write Regulation 28 reports, which are basically designed to point out where there's issues to prevent future deaths. And we now know that as late as June, there were deaths happening as a result of the AstraZeneca vaccine, and coroners were reporting about it. Now, the UK government has not put a statement out about this. They just quietly withdrew the vaccine across the summer of 2021. But I think what's more worrying is the fact that we haven't had an investigation and a lessons learned exercise so that this doesn't happen again. So I think there's huge questions over the regulator in the UK. What are your thoughts on this, Tina?
Well, they seem to have willful blindness, don't they? They just don't. They're just not doing their job properly. I know. I always believed, like everyone else did, that they were there to keep us safe and to check everything. And when they were first released under the EUA, the Emergency Use Authorization, we all assumed that the MHRA had seen very good data to show that they were safe. And actually, when the studies were then published, it became very obvious, and it stated clearly in the study documents, they didn't do any toxicology studies. So they didn't do any studies to prove that it was fine to have repeated doses, more than two doses, I think, it was tested, and that was it. And then, not in humans anyway, and they didn't do any carcinogenicity studies. So they didn't do any studies to prove that it didn't cause cancer in the long term or short term. They didn't do any fertility studies, which is bizarre. Then you're going to roll it out to the whole population. And now we are seeing signs that maybe it's causing infertility. In Hungary, the birth rate's down 20%. In the UK, it's down. In Germany and Italy, it's down. So all these toxicology, carcinogenicity, gene toxicity, fertility, they didn't do a biodistribution study. They didn't know where it went to in the body. Unbelievable that you would release something and give a certificate, even an EUA, to something that you don't know this information. And it's not like they then didn't concentrate on the vulnerable and say, well, look, we're going to give it to the elderly because they're the ones who are most vulnerable from this. Let's protect them. Let's give it to them and do more studies and find out more before we roll it out to everyone else. No, they didn't. Do you remember they said, oh, if you're over 80, come and have it. If you're over 70, come and have it. If you're over 60. And then everyone just got used to they were being called up in their sort of, you know, decades in their age groups. And everyone just dutifully turned up and went along. And actually, the risk wasn't the same to everybody. And therefore, the risk benefit isn't the same. And we've all been treated as if we're exactly identical, and we're not. And it's probably the risks are different between the sexes. They're different between the age groups. We need to be looking at the different vaccines that have been used in people that have got adverse reactions, the different doses that have been used in the deaths and so on. And we've got to do this analysis. There's been no proper scientific report and discussion about it. And that's very disappointing. And that rests on the shoulders of the MHRA.
Well, do you know what, Tina? You've said everything and you've put everything so clearly and in an intelligent, you know, basic way that everybody could understand, that after this, when this show goes up on the catch up tomorrow, I'm going to ask all of my followers to tag their MP, because I think MPs should be aware of this, because I think there's an awful lot of MPs that just don't realize actually that all of this information is out there, and also that the regulator is doing such a terrible job at protecting people in the UK, which is their primary responsibility. Right now, okay, we've got a couple of minutes left, Tina. What I'd like to do for that couple of minutes, so keep it brief, is just to hear your opinion on how you think doctors and also MPs that are speaking up, how they've been treated recently.
Oh, I think it's appalling. They've been so disrespected. There's not been free speech. Everyone is entitled to their opinion. They have been presenting facts and have been told that they are, you know, have been gaslighted, haven't they? And actually, if you look at the Heart group, if people might be interested to look at this, it's heartgroup.org. And they did a review of the full facts, a fact check on the Andrew Bridgen, I never quite know how to pronounce his surname, MP. And they went through everything he said that the fact checker said wasn't true. And it's a very, very interesting report to read, actually, point by point. And you can see what they say. And it's all data, you know, with references and everything, and shows that actually what he said was absolutely right. I just think it's appalling. Sir Christopher Chope has been trying to stand up for the vaccine injured. Shame on the MPs who didn't bother to turn up to the discussion. You know, shame on them. I can't believe that they're supposed to be public servants and we pay them. You know.
I know, and I hear that the reason quite a lot of them aren't speaking out is because they're worried about their careers. But to be honest with you, that's not a reason for going into politics. You're there to represent your constituents and do your best for the country, not to make a career for yourself. Tina, thank you so much for coming on. You, some of the things that you've talked about have been absolutely enlightening. I'll make sure that lots of people hear about this interview and listen into it. Thank you so much. I hope you'll join me on the show at some point in the future again. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio. Thank you.